he said. Do you want me to show you? Splendid! An older woman appeared and wagged a finger at Boy. You must have these girls home by midnight, she said in an American accent. Not a second later, please. Lloyd guessed she must be Daisy's mother. The tall man in the military outfit replied, Leave it to the army, Mrs. Peshkoff. We'll be on time. Behind Mrs. Peshkoff came Earl Fitzherbert, with a fat woman who must have been his wife. Lloyd would have liked to question the Earl about his government's policy on Spain. Two cars were waiting for them outside. The Earl, his wife, and Daisy's mother got into a black and cream Rolls-Royce Phantom III. Boy and his group piled into the other car, a dark blue Daimler E20 limousine, the royal family's favorite car. There were seven young people, including Lloyd. Ava seemed to be with the soldier, who introduced himself to Lloyd as Lieutenant Jimmy Murray. The third girl was his sister, May, and the other boy, a slimmer, quieter version of Boy, turned out to be Andy Fitzherbert. Lloyd gave the chauffeur directions to the Gaiety. He noticed that Jimmy Murray discreetly slipped his arm around Ava's waist. Her reaction was to move slightly closer to him. Obviously, they were courting. Lloyd was happy for her. She was not a pretty girl, but she was intelligent and charming. He liked her, and he was glad she had found herself a tall soldier. He wondered, though, how others in this upper-class social set would react if Jimmy announced he was going to marry a half-Jewish German girl. It occurred to him that the others formed two more couples, Andy and May and, annoyingly, Boy and Daisy. Lloyd was the odd one out. Not wanting to stare at them, he studied the polished mahogany window surrounds. The car went up Ludgate Hill to St. Paul's Cathedral. Take Cheapside, Lloyd said to the driver. Boy took a long pull from a silver hip flask. Wiping his mouth, he said, You know your way around, Williams. I live here, said Lloyd. I was born in the East End. How splendid, said Boy, and Lloyd was not sure whether he was being thoughtlessly polite or unpleasantly sarcastic. All the seats were taken at the Gaiety, but there was plenty of standing room, and the audience moved around constantly, greeting friends and going to the bar. They were dressed up, the women in brightly colored frocks, the men in their best suits. The air was warm and smoky, and there was a powerful odor of spilled beer. Lloyd found a place for his group near the back. Their clothes identified them as visitors from the West End, but they were not the only ones. Music halls were popular with all classes. On stage, a middle-aged performer in a red dress and blonde wig was doing a double entendre routine.
I said to him, I'm not letting you into my passage.
The audience roared with laughter.
He said to me, I can see it from here, love. I told him, you keep your nose out.
She was pretending indignation.
He said, it looks to me like it needs a good clean out. Well, I ask you.
Lloyd saw that Daisy was grinning widely. He leaned over and murmured in her ear. Do you realize it's a man?
No,
she said. Look at the hands.
Oh, my God, she said. She's a man.
Lloyd's cousin David walked past, spotted Lloyd, and came back.
What are you all dressed up for?
He said in a Cockney accent. He was wearing a knotted scarf and a cloth cap.
Hello, Dave. How's life?
I'm going to Spain with you and Lenny Griffiths, Dave said.
No, you're not, said Lloyd. You're 15.
Boys my age fought in the Great War, but they were no use. Ask your father. Anyway, who says I'm going?
Your sister Millie, Dave said, and he walked on.
Boy said, What do people usually drink in this place, Williams?
Lloyd thought Boy did not need any more alcohol, but he replied, Pints of best bitter for the men and port and lemon for the girls.
Port and lemon?
It's port diluted with lemonade.
How perfectly ghastly.
Boy disappeared. The comedian reached the climax of the act.
I said to him, You fool, that's the wrong passage!
She, or he, went off to gales of applause. Millie appeared in front of Lloyd.
Hello,
she said. She looked at Daisy.
Who's your friend?
Lloyd was glad Millie looked so pretty, in her sophisticated black dress, with a row of fake pearls and a discreet touch of makeup. He said, Miss Peshkoff, allow me to present my sister, Miss Leckwith. Millie? This is Daisy.
They shook hands. Daisy said, I'm very glad to meet Lloyd's sister.
Half-sister, to be exact, said Millie.
Lloyd explained. My father was killed in the Great War. I never knew him. My mother married again when I was still a baby.
Enjoy the show, Millie said, turning away.
Then, as she left, she murmured to Lloyd, Now I see why Ruby Carter has no chance. Lloyd groaned inwardly. His mother had obviously told the whole family that he was romancing Ruby.
Daisy said, Who's Ruby Carter?
She's a maid at Chimley. You gave her the money to see a dentist.
I remember.
So her name is being romantically linked with yours?
In the imagination of my mother, yes.
Daisy laughed at his discomfiture. So you're not going to marry your housemaid?
I'm not going to marry Ruby.
She might suit you very well.
Lloyd gave her a direct look. We don't always fall in love with the most suitable people, do we?
She looked at the stage. The show was approaching its end, and the entire cast was beginning a familiar song. The audience joined in enthusiastically. The standing customers at the back linked arms and swayed in time, and Boy's party did likewise. When the curtain came down, Boy still had not reappeared.
I'll look for him, Lloyd said. I think I know where he might be.
The Gaiety had a ladies' toilet, but the men's was a backyard with an earth closet and several halved oil drums. Lloyd found Boy puking into one of the drums. He gave Boy a handkerchief to wipe his mouth, then took his arm and led him through the emptying theatre and outside to the Daimler limousine. The others were waiting. They all got in and Boy immediately fell asleep. When they got back to the West End, Andy Fitzherbert told the driver to go first to the Murray House, in a modest street near Trafalgar Square. Getting out of the car with May, he said, You lot go on. I'll see May to her door, then walk home. Lloyd presumed that Andy was planning a romantic goodnight on May's doorstep. They drove on to Mayfair. As the car was approaching Grosvenor Square, where Daisy and Ava were living, Jimmy told the chauffeur, Just stop at the corner, please. Then he said quietly to Lloyd, I say, Williams, would you mind taking Miss Peshkoff to the door and I'll follow with Fraulein Rothman in half a minute?
Of course.
Jimmy wanted to kiss Ava goodnight in the car, obviously. Boy would know nothing about it. He was snoring. The chauffeur would pretend to be oblivious in the expectation of a tip. Lloyd got out of the car and handed Daisy out. When she grasped his hand, he got a thrill like a mild electric shock. He took her arm and they walked slowly along the pavement. At the midpoint between two street lamps, where the light was dimmest, Daisy stopped.
Let's give them time, she said.
Lloyd said, I'm so glad Ava has a paramour.
Me too.
He took a breath. I can't say the same about you and Boy Fitzherbert.
He got me presented at court, Daisy said, and I danced with the king in the nightclub. It was in all the American newspapers.
And that's why you're courting him, Lloyd said incredulously.
Not only. He likes all the things I do. Parties and racehorses and beautiful clothes. He's such fun. He even has his own airplane.
None of that means anything, Lloyd said.
Give him up.
Be my girlfriend instead. She looked pleased, but she laughed.
You're crazy, she said, but I like you.
I mean it, he said desperately. I can't stop thinking about you. Even though you're the last person in the world I should marry. She laughed again.
You say the rudest things. I don't know why I talk to you. I guess I think you're nice under your clumsy manners.
I'm not really clumsy, only with you.
I believe you. But I'm not going to marry a penniless socialist.
Lloyd had opened his heart only to be charmingly rejected, and now he felt miserable. He looked back at the Daimler.
I wonder how long they're going to be. He said disconsolately.
Daisy said, I might kiss a socialist, though, just to see what it's like. For a moment he did not react. He assumed she was speaking theoretically. But a girl would never say something like that, theoretically. It was an invitation. He had almost been stupid enough to miss it. He moved closer, putting his hands on her small waist. She tilted her face up, and her beauty took his breath away. He bent his head and kissed her mouth softly. She did not close her eyes, and neither did he. He felt tremendously aroused, staring into her blue eyes as he moved his lips against hers. She opened her mouth slightly, and he touched her parted lips with the tip of his tongue. A moment later, he felt her tongue respond. She was still looking at him. He was in paradise, and he wanted to stay locked in this embrace for all eternity. She pressed her body to his. He had an erection, and he was embarrassed in case she might feel it, so he eased back. But she pushed forward again, and he understood, looking into her eyes, that she wanted to feel his penis pressed against her soft body. The realization heated him unbearably. He felt as if he was going to ejaculate, and it occurred to him that she might even want him to. Then he heard the door of the Daimler open, and Jimmy Murray speaking with slightly unnatural loudness, as if giving a warning. Lloyd broke the embrace with Daisy.
"Well," she murmured in a surprised tone, "that was an unexpected pleasure."
Lloyd said hoarsely,
"More than a pleasure."
Then Jimmy and Ava were beside them, and they all walked to the door of Mrs. Peshkoff's house. It was a grand building with steps up to a covered porch. Lloyd wondered if the porch might give shelter enough for another kiss, but as they climbed the steps, the door was opened from the inside by a man in evening dress, probably the butler Lloyd had spoken to earlier. How glad he was that he had made that phone call. The two girls said goodnight demurely, giving no hint that only seconds ago they had both been locked in passionate embraces. Then the door closed, and they were gone. Lloyd and Jimmy went back down the steps.
"I'm going to walk from here," Jimmy said. "Shall I tell the chauffeur to drive you back to the East End? You must be 3 or 4 miles from home. And boy won't care. He'll sleep until breakfast time, I should think."
"That's thoughtful of you, Murray, and I appreciate it. But believe it or not, I feel like walking. Lots to think about."
"As you wish. Good night, then."
"Good night," said Lloyd, and with his mind in a whirl and his erection slowly deflating, he turned east and headed for home.
4. London's social season ended in the middle of August, and still Boy Fitzherbert had not proposed marriage to Daisy Peshkoff. Daisy was hurt and puzzled. Everyone knew they were courting. They saw one another almost every day. Earl Fitzherbert talked to Daisy like a daughter, and even the suspicious Princess Bea had warmed to her. Boy kissed her whenever he got the chance, but said nothing about the future. The long series of lavish lunches and dinners, glittering parties and balls, traditional sporting events and champagne picnics that made up the London season came to an abrupt end. Many of the new friends Daisy had made suddenly left town. Most of them went to country houses where, as far as she could gather, they would spend their time hunting foxes, stalking deer, and shooting birds. Daisy and Olga stayed for Ava Rothman's wedding. Unlike Boy, Jimmy Murray was in a rush to marry the woman he loved. The ceremony was held at his parents' parish church in Chelsea. Daisy felt she had done a great job with Ava. She had taught her friend how to choose clothes that suited her, smart styles without frills, in plain, strong colors that flattered her dark hair and brown eyes. Gaining in confidence, Ava had learned how to use her natural warmth and quick intelligence to charm men and women. And Jimmy had fallen in love with her. He was no movie star, but he was tall and craggily attractive. He came from a military family with a modest fortune, so Ava would be comfortable, though not rich. The British were as prejudiced as anyone else, and at first General Murray and Mrs. Murray had not been thrilled at the prospect of their son marrying a half-Jewish German refugee. Ava had won them over quickly, but many of their friends still expressed coded doubts. At the wedding, Daisy had been told that Ava was exotic, Jimmy was courageous, and the Murrays were marvelously broad-minded, all ways of making the best of an unsuitable match. Jimmy had written formally to Dr. Rothman in Berlin, and received permission to ask Ava for her hand in marriage, but the German authorities had refused to let the Rothman family come to the wedding. Ava had said tearfully, "They hate Jews so much, you'd think they'd be happy to see them leave the country." Boy's father, Fitz, had heard this remark, and had later spoken to Daisy about it. Tell your friend Ava not to say too much about Jews if she can avoid it, he had said, in the tone of one who gives a friendly warning. Having a half-Jewish wife is not going to help Jimmy's army career, you know. Daisy had not passed on this unpleasant counsel. The happy couple went off to Nice for their honeymoon. Daisy realized with a pang of guilt that she was relieved to get Ava off her hands. Boy and his political pals disliked Jews so much that Ava was becoming a problem. Already the friendship between Boy and Jimmy had ended. Boy had refused to be Jimmy's best man. After the wedding, Daisy and Olga were invited by the Fitzherberts to a shooting party at their country house in Wales. Daisy's hopes rose. Now that Ava was out of the way, there was nothing to stop Boy proposing. The Earl and Princess must surely assume he was on the point of it. Perhaps they planned for him to do so this weekend. Daisy and Olga went to Paddington Station on a Friday morning and took a train west. They crossed the heart of England, rich rolling farmland dotted with hamlets, each with its stone church spire rising from a stand of ancient trees. They had a first-class carriage to themselves, and Olga asked Daisy what she thought Boy might do. He must know I like him, Daisy said. I've let him kiss me enough times. Have you shown any interest in anyone else? Her mother asked shrewdly. Daisy suppressed the guilty memory of that brief moment of foolishness with Lloyd Williams. Boy could not possibly know about that. And anyway, she had not seen Lloyd again, nor had she replied to the three letters he had sent her. No one, she said. Then it's because of Ava, said Olga, and now she's gone. The train went through a long tunnel under the estuary of the River Severn, and when it emerged, they were in Wales. Bedraggled sheep grazed the hills, and in the cleft of each valley was a small mining town, its pithead winding gear rising from a scatter of ugly industrial buildings. Earl Fitzherbert's black and cream Rolls-Royce was waiting for them at Aberowen Station. The town was dismal, Daisy thought, with small grey stone houses in rows along the steep hillsides. They drove a mile or so out of town to the house, Tygwyn. Daisy gasped with pleasure as they passed through the gates. Tygwyn was enormous and elegant, with long rows of tall windows in a perfectly classical façade. It was set in elaborate gardens of flowers, shrubs, and specimen trees that clearly were the pride of the Earl himself. What a joy it would be to be mistress of this house, she thought. The British aristocracy might no longer rule the world, but they had perfected the art of living, and Daisy longed to be one of them. Tygwyn meant white house, but the place was actually grey. And Daisy learned why when she touched the stonework with her hand and got cold dust on her fingertips. She was given a room called the Gardenia Suite. That evening she and Boy sat on the terrace before dinner and watched the sun go down over the purple mountaintop, Boy smoking a cigar, and Daisy sipping champagne. They were alone for a while, but Boy said nothing about marriage. Over the weekend her anxiety grew. Boy had plenty more chances to speak to her alone. She made sure of that. On Saturday, the men went shooting, but Daisy went out to meet them at the end of the afternoon, and she and Boy walked back through the woods together. On Sunday morning, the Fitzherberts and most of their guests went to the Anglican church in the town. After the service, Boy took Daisy to a pub called the Two Crowns, where squat, broad-shouldered miners in flat caps stared at her in her lavender cashmere coat, as if Boy had brought in a leopard on a leash. She told him that she and her mother would soon have to go back to Buffalo, but he did not take the hint. Could it simply be that he liked her, but not enough to marry her? By lunch on Sunday she was desperate. Tomorrow she and her mother were to return to London. If Boy had not proposed by then, his parents would begin to think he was not serious, and there would be no more invitations to Tygwyn. That prospect frightened Daisy. She had made up her mind to marry Boy. She wanted to be Viscountess Aberowen, and then one day Countess Fitzherbert. She had always been rich, but
but she craved the respect and deference that went with social status. She longed to be addressed as Your Ladyship. She coveted Princess Bea's diamond tiara. She wanted to count royalty among her friends. She knew Boy liked her, and there was no doubt about his desire when he kissed her. He needs something to spur him on, Olga murmured to Daisy as they drank their after-lunch coffee with the other ladies in the morning room.
But what?
There is one thing that never fails with men. Daisy raised her eyebrows.
Sex?
She and her mother talked about most things, but generally skirted around this subject.
Pregnancy would do it,
Olga said, but that only happens for sure when you don't want it.
What then?
You need to give him a glimpse of the promised land, but not let him in. Daisy shook her head.
I'm not certain, but I think he may have already been to the promised land with someone else.
Who?
I don't know. A maid? An actress? A widow?
I'm guessing, but he just doesn't have that virginal air.
You're right. He doesn't.
That means you have to offer him something he can't get from the others. Something he'd do anything for. Daisy wondered briefly where her mother got this wisdom, having spent her life in a cold marriage. Perhaps she had done a lot of thinking about how her husband, Lev, had been stolen from her by his mistress, Marga. Anyway, there was nothing Daisy could offer Boy that he couldn't get from another girl, was there? The women were finishing their coffee and heading to their bedrooms for the afternoon nap. The men were still in the dining room, smoking their cigars, but they would follow in a quarter of an hour. Daisy stood up. Olga said,
What are you going to do?
I'm not sure, she said. I'll think of something.
She left the room. She was going to go to Boy's room, she had decided, but she did not want to say so in case her mother objected. She would be waiting for him when he came for his nap. The servants also took a break at that time of day, so it was unlikely anyone would come into the room. She would have Boy on his own then. But what would she say or do? She did not know. She would have to improvise. She went to the gardenia suite, brushed her teeth, dabbed Jean Nattet perfume on her neck, and walked quietly along the corridor to Boy's room. No one saw her go in. He had a spacious bedroom with a view of misty mountain tops. It felt as if it might have been his for many years. There were masculine leather chairs, pictures of airplanes and racehorses on the wall, a cedarwood humidor full of fragrant cigars, and a side table with decanters of whiskey and brandy and a tray of crystal glasses. She pulled open a drawer and saw Tiguin writing paper, a bottle of ink, and pens and pencils. The paper was blue with a Fitzherbert crest. Would that one day be her crest? She wondered what Boy would say when he found her here. Would he be pleased, take her into his arms and kiss her? Or would he be angry that his privacy had been invaded and accuse her of snooping? She had to take the risk. She went into the adjoining dressing room. There was a small wash basin with a mirror over it. His shaving tackle was on the marble surround. Daisy thought she would like to learn to shave her husband. How intimate that would be. She opened the wardrobe doors and looked at his clothes. Formal morning dress, tweed suits, riding clothes, a leather pilot's jacket with a fur lining, and two evening suits. That gave her an idea. She recalled how aroused Boy had been at Bing Westhampton's house back in June by the sight of her and the other girls dressed as men. That evening had been the first time he kissed her. She was not sure why he had been so excited. Such things were generally inexplicable. Lizzie Westhampton said some men liked women to spank their bottoms. How could you account for that? Perhaps she should dress in his clothes now. Something he'd do anything for, her mother had said. Was this it? She stared at the row of suits on hangers, the stack of folded white shirts, the polished leather shoes, each with its wooden tree inside. Would it work? Did she have time? Did she have anything to lose? She could pick the clothes she needed, take them to the gardenia suite, change there, then hurry back, hoping no one saw her on the way. No, There was no time for that. His cigar was not long enough. She had to change here, and fast, or not at all. She made up her mind. She pulled her dress off. She was in danger now. Until this moment, she might have explained her presence here, just about plausibly, by pretending she had lost her bearings in T. Gwynne's miles of corridors and gone into the wrong room by mistake. But no girl's reputation could survive being found in a man's room in her underwear. She took the top shirt off the pile. The collar had to be attached with a stud, she saw with a groan. She found a dozen starched collars in a drawer with a box of studs, and fixed one to the shirt, then pulled the shirt over her head. She heard a man's heavy footsteps in the corridor outside and froze, her heart beating like a big drum, but the steps went by. She decided to wear formal morning dress. The striped trousers had no suspenders attached, but she found some in another drawer. She figured out how to button the suspenders to the trousers, then pulled the trousers on. The waist was big enough for two of her. She pushed her stockinged feet into a pair of shiny black shoes and laced them. She buttoned the shirt and put on a silver tie. The knot was wrong, but it did not matter, and anyway she did not know the correct way to tie it, so she left it as it was. She put on a fawn double-breasted waistcoat and a black tailcoat. Then she looked in the full-length mirror on the inside of the wardrobe door. The clothes were baggy, but she looked cute anyway. Now that she had time, she put gold links in the shirt cuffs and a white handkerchief in the breast pocket of the coat. Something was missing. She stared at herself in the mirror until she figured out what else she needed. A hat. She opened another cupboard and saw a row of hat boxes on a high shelf. She found a gray top hat and perched it on the back of her head. She remembered the mustache. She did not have an eyebrow pencil with her. She returned to Boy's bedroom and bent over the fireplace. It was still summer, and there was no fire. She got some soot on her fingertip, returned to the mirror, and carefully drew a mustache on her upper lip. She was ready. She sat in one of the leather armchairs to wait for him. Her instinct told her she was doing the right thing, but rationally it seemed bizarre. However, there was no accounting for arousal. She herself had got wet inside when he took her up in his plane. It had been impossible for them to canoodle while he was concentrating on flying the little aircraft, and that was just as well, for soaring through the air had been so exciting that she probably would have let him do anything he wanted. However, boys could be unpredictable, and she feared he might be angry. When that happened, his handsome face would twist into an unattractive grimace. He would tap his foot very quickly, and he could become quite cruel. Once, when a waiter with a limp had brought him the wrong drink, he had said, "Just hobble back to the bar and bring me the scotch I ordered. Being a cripple doesn't make you deaf, does it?" The wretched man had flushed with shame. She wondered what Boy would say to her if he was angered by her being in his room. He arrived 5 minutes later. She heard his tread outside, and realized she already knew him well enough to recognize his step. The door opened and he came in without seeing her. She put on a deep voice and said, "Hello, old chap. How are you?" He started and said, "Good God!" Then he looked again. "Daisy?" She stood up. "The same," she said in her normal voice. He was still staring at her in surprise. She doffed the top hat, gave a little bow and said, "At your service." She replaced the hat on her head at an angle. After a long moment, he recovered from the shock and grinned. "Thank God," she thought. He said, "I say, that topper does suit you." She came closer. "I put it on to please you. Jolly nice of you, I must say." She turned her face up invitingly. She liked kissing him. In truth, she liked kissing most men. She was secretly embarrassed by how much she liked it. She had even enjoyed kissing girls at her boarding school where they did not see a boy for weeks on end. He bent his head and touched his lips to hers. Her hat fell off, and they both giggled. Quickly he thrust his tongue into her mouth. She relaxed and enjoyed it. He was enthusiastic about all sensual pleasures, and she was excited by his eagerness. She reminded herself that she had a purpose. Things were progressing nicely, but she wanted him to propose. Would he be satisfied with just a kiss? She needed him to want more. Often, if they had more than a few hasty moments, he would fondle her breasts. A lot depended on how much wine he had drunk with lunch. He had a large capacity, but there came a point when he lost the urge. She moved her body, pressing herself to him. He put a hand on her chest, but she was wearing a baggy waistcoat of woolen cloth, and he could not find her small breasts. He grunted in frustration. Then his hand roamed across her stomach and inside the waistband of the loose-fitting trousers. She had never before let him touch her down there. She still had on a silk petticoat and substantial cotton underdrawers, so he surely could not feel much. But his hand went to the fork of her thighs and pressed firmly against her through the layers. She felt a twinge of pleasure. She pulled away from him. Panting, he said, "Have I gone too far?"
"Lock the door," she said. "Oh my goodness."
He went to the door, turned the key in the lock, and came back. They embraced again, and he resumed where he had left off. She touched the front of his trousers, found his erect penis through the cloth, and grasped it firmly. He groaned with pleasure. She pulled away again. The shadow of anger crossed his face. An unpleasant memory came back to her. Once, when she had made a boy called Theo Kaufman take his hand off her breasts, he had turned nasty and called her a prick-teaser. She had never seen that boy again, but the insult had made her feel irrationally ashamed. Momentarily she feared that boy might be about to make a similar accusation. Then his face softened, and he said, "I am dreadfully keen on you, you know." This was her moment. Sink or swim, she told herself.
"We shouldn't be doing this,"
she said with a regret that was not greatly exaggerated.
"Why not? We're not even engaged."
The word hung in the air for a long moment. For a girl to say that was tantamount to a proposal. She watched his face, terrified that he would take fright, turn away, mumble excuses, and ask her to leave. He said nothing.
"I want to make you happy," she said. "But I do love you, Daisy," he said.
That was not enough. She smiled at him and said,
"Do you? Ever such a lot?"
She said nothing but looked at him expectantly. At last he said,
"Will you marry me?"
"Oh, yes," she said, and she kissed him again. With her mouth pressed to his, she unbuttoned his fly, burrowed through his underclothing, found his penis, and took it out. The skin was silky and hot. She stroked it, remembering a conversation with the West Hampton twins.
"You can rub his thing," Lindy had said, and Lizzie had added, "until it squirts."
Daisy was intrigued and excited by the idea of making a man do that. She grasped a bit harder. Then she remembered Lindy's next remark.
"Or you can suck it. They like that best of all."
She moved her lips away from boys and spoke into his ear.
"I'll do anything for my husband," she said.
Then she knelt down. 5. It was the wedding of the year. Daisy and Boy were married at St. Margaret's Church, Westminster, on Saturday, October 3rd, 1936. Daisy was disappointed it was not Westminster Abbey, but she was told that was for the royal family only. Coco Chanel made her wedding dress. Depression fashion was for simple lines and minimal extravagance. Daisy's floor-length bias-cut satin gown had pretty butterfly sleeves and a short train that could be carried by one pageboy. Her father, Lev Peshkov, came across the Atlantic for the ceremony. Her mother, Olga, agreed, for the sake of appearances, to sit beside him in church and generally pretend that they were a more or less happily married couple. Daisy's nightmare was that at some point Marga would show up with Lev's illegitimate son Greg on her arm, but it did not happen. The West Hampton twins and May Murray were bridesmaids, and Ava Murray was matron of honor. Boy had been grumpy about Ava's being half-Jewish. He had not wanted to invite her at all, but Daisy had insisted. She stood in the ancient church, conscious that she looked heartbreakingly beautiful, and happily gave herself to Boy Fitzherbert, body and soul. She signed the register, Daisy Fitzherbert, Viscountess Aberowen. She had been practicing that signature for weeks, carefully tearing the paper into unreadable shreds afterward. Now she was entitled to it. It was her name. Processing out of the church, Fitz took Olga's arm amiably, but Princess Bea put a yard of empty space between herself and Lev. Princess Bea was not a nice person. She was friendly enough toward Daisy's mother, and if there was a heavy strain of condescension in her tone, Olga did not notice it, so relations were amiable. But Bea did not like Lev. Daisy now realized that Lev lacked the veneer of social respectability. He walked and talked, ate and drank, smoked and laughed, and scratched like a gangster, and he did not care what people thought. He did what he liked because he was an American millionaire, just as Fitz did what he liked because he was an English earl. Daisy had always known this, but it struck her with extra force when she saw her father with all these upper-class English people at the wedding breakfast in the grand ballroom of the Dorchester Hotel. But it did not matter now. She was Lady Aberowen, and that could not be taken away from her. Nevertheless, Bea's constant hostility to Lev was an irritant, like a slightly bad smell or a distant buzzing noise, giving Daisy a feeling of dissatisfaction. Sitting beside Lev at the top table, Bea always turned slightly away. When he spoke to her, she replied briefly without meeting his eye. He seemed not to notice, smiling and drinking champagne, but Daisy, seated on Lev's other side, knew he had not failed to read the signs. He was uncouth, not stupid. When the toasts were over and the men began to smoke, Lev, who as the father of the bride was paying the bill, looked along the table and said, "Well, Fitz, I hope you enjoyed your meal. Were the wines up to your standards?"
"Very good, thank you.
I must say, I thought it was a damn fine spread." Bea tutted audibly. Men were not supposed to say damn in her hearing. Lev turned to her. He was smiling, but Daisy knew the dangerous look in his eye. "Why, Princess, have I offended you?" She did not want to reply, but he looked expectantly at her, and did not turn his gaze aside. At last she spoke. "I prefer not to hear coarse language," she said. Lev took a cigar from his case. He did not light it at once, but sniffed it and rolled it between his fingers. "Let me tell you a story," he said, and he looked up and down the table to make sure they were all listening. Fitz, Olga, Boy, Daisy, and Bear. "When I was a kid, my father was accused of grazing livestock on someone else's land. No big deal, you might think, even if he was guilty. But he was arrested, and the land agent built a scaffold in the North Meadow. Then the soldiers came and grabbed me and my brother and our mother and took us there. My father was on the scaffold with a noose around his neck. Then the landlord arrived." Daisy had never heard this story. She looked at her mother. Olga seemed equally surprised. The little group at the table were all very silent now. "We were forced to watch while my father was hanged," Lev said. He turned to Bea. "And you know something strange? The landlord's sister was there as well." He put the cigar in his mouth, wetting the end, and took it out again. Daisy saw that Bea had turned pale. Was this about her? "The sister was about 19 years old, and she was a princess," Lev said, looking at his cigar. Daisy heard Bea let out a small cry, and realized this story was about her. "She stood there and watched the hanging, cold as ice," Lev said. Then he looked directly at Bea. "Now that's what I call coarse," he said. There was a long moment of silence. Then Lev put the cigar back in his mouth and said, "Has anyone got a light?" 6. Lloyd Williams sat at the table in the kitchen of his mother's house in Aldgate, anxiously studying a map. It was Sunday, October 4th, 1936, and today there was going to be a riot. The old Roman town of London, built on a hill beside the River Thames, was now the financial district, called the City. West of this hill were the palaces of the rich, and the theatres and shops and cathedrals that catered to them. The house in which Lloyd sat was to the east of the hill, near the docks and the slums. Here, for centuries, waves of immigrants had landed, determined to work their fingers to the bone, so that their grandchildren could one day move from the East End to the West End. The map Lloyd was looking at so intently was in a special edition of the Daily Worker, the Communist Party newspaper, and it showed the route of today's march by the British Union of Fascists. They planned to assemble outside the Tower of London, on the border between the City and the East End, then march east, straight into the overwhelmingly Jewish borough of Stepney, unless Lloyd and people who thought as he did could stop them. There were 330,000 Jews in Britain, according to the newspaper, and half of them lived in the East End. Most were refugees from Russia, Poland, and Germany, where they had lived in fear that on any day the police, the army, or the Cossacks might ride into town, robbing families, beating old men and outraging young women, lining fathers and brothers up against the wall to be shot. Here in the London slums, those Jews had found a place where they had as much right to live as anyone else. How would they feel if they looked out their windows to see, marching down their own streets, a gang of uniformed thugs sworn to wipe them all out? Lloyd felt that it just could not be allowed to happen. The Worker pointed out that from the Tower, there were really only two routes the marchers could take. One went through Gardener's Corner, a five-way junction known as the Gateway to the East End. The other led along Royal Mint Street and the narrow Cable Street. There were a dozen other routes for an individual using side streets, but not for a march. St. George Street led to Catholic Wapping rather than Jewish Stepney, and was therefore no use to the fascists. The Worker called for a human wall to block Gardener's Corner and Cable Street and stop the march. The paper often called for things that did not happen: strikes, revolutions, or, most recently, an alliance of all left parties to form a people's front. The human wall might be just another fantasy. It would take many thousands of people to effectively close off the East End. Lloyd did not know whether enough would show up. All he knew for sure was that there would be trouble. At the table with Lloyd were his parents, Bernie and Ethel, his sister Millie, and 16-year-old Lenny Griffiths from Aberowen, in his Sunday suit. Lenny was part of a small army of Welsh miners who had come to London to join the counter-demonstration. Bernie looked up from his newspaper and said to Lenny, "The fascists claim that the train fares for all you Welshmen to come to London have been paid by the big Jews." Lenny swallowed a mouthful of fried egg. "I don't know any big Jews," he said, "unless you count Mrs. Levy Sweetshop. She's quite big. Anyway, I came to London on the back of a lorry with 60 Welsh lambs going to Smithfield Meat Market." Millie said, "That accounts for the smell." Ethel said, "Millie, how rude." Lenny was sharing Lloyd's bedroom, and he had confided that after the demonstration he was not planning to return to Aberowen. He and Dave Williams were going to Spain to join the international brigades being formed to fight the fascist insurrection. "Did you get a passport?" Lloyd had asked. Getting a passport was not difficult, but the applicant did have to provide a reference from a clergyman, doctor, lawyer, or other person of status, so a young person could not easily keep it secret. "No need," Lenny said. "We go to Victoria Station and get a weekend return ticket to Paris. You can do that without a passport." Lloyd had vaguely known that. It was a loophole intended for the convenience of the prosperous middle class. Now the anti-fascists were taking advantage of it. "How much is the ticket?" £3.15. Lloyd had raised his eyebrows. That was more money than an unemployed coal miner was likely to have. Lenny had added, "But the Independent Labour Party is paying for my ticket, and the Communist Party for Dave's." They must have lied about their ages. "Then what happens when you get to Paris?" Lloyd had asked. "We'll be met by the French communists at the Gare du Nord." He pronounced it Gare du Nord. He did not speak a word of French. "From there we'll be escorted to the Spanish border." Lloyd had delayed his own departure. He told people he wanted to soothe his parents' worries, but the truth was he could not give up on Daisy. He still dreamed of her throwing Boy over. It was hopeless. She did not even answer his letters, but he could not forget her. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and the USA had agreed with Germany and Italy to adopt a policy of non-intervention in Spain, which meant none of them would supply weapons to either side. This, in itself, was infuriating to Lloyd. Surely the democracies should support the elected government. But what was worse, Germany and Italy were breaching the agreement every day, as Lloyd's mother and Uncle Billy pointed out at many public meetings held that autumn in Britain to discuss Spain. Earl Fitzherbert, as the government minister responsible, defended the policy stoutly, saying the Spanish government should not be armed for fear it would go communist. This was a self-fulfilling prophecy, as Ethel had argued in a scathing speech. The one nation willing to support the government of Spain was the Soviet Union, and the Spaniards would naturally gravitate toward the only country in the world that helped them. The truth was that the conservatives felt Spain had elected people who were dangerously left-wing. Men such as Fitzherbert would not be unhappy if the Spanish government was violently overthrown and replaced by right-wing extremists. Lloyd seethed with frustration. Then had come this chance to fight fascism at home. "It's ridiculous," Bernie had said a week ago when the march had been announced. "The Metropolitan Police must force them to change the route. They have the right to march, of course, but not in Stepney." However, the police said they did not have the power to interfere with a perfectly legal demonstration. Bernie and Ethel and the mayors of 8 London boroughs had been in a delegation that begged the Home Secretary, Sir John Simon, to ban the march or at least divert it, but he too claimed he had no power to act. The question of what to do next had split the Labour Party, the Jewish community, and the Williams family. The Jewish People's Council Against Fascism and Anti-Semitism, founded by Bernie and others 3 months ago, had called for a massive counter-demonstration that would keep the fascists out of Jewish streets. Their slogan was the Spanish phrase, "No pasarán," meaning "they shall not pass," the cry of the anti-fascist defenders of Madrid. The council was a small organization with a grand name. It occupied 2 upstairs rooms in a building on Commercial Road, and it owned a Gestetner duplicating machine and a couple of old typewriters. But it commanded huge support in the East End. In 48 hours, it had collected an incredible 100,000 signatures on a petition calling for the march to be banned. Still, the government did nothing. Only one major political party supported the counter-demonstration, and that was the Communists. The protest was also backed by the fringe Independent Labour Party, to which Lenny belonged. The other parties were against. Ethel said, "I see the Jewish Chronicle has advised its readers to stay off the streets today." This was the problem, in Lloyd's opinion. A lot of people were taking the view that it was best to keep out of trouble, but that would give the fascists a free hand. Bernie, who was Jewish, though not religious, said to Ethel, "How can you quote the Jewish Chronicle at me? It believes Jews should not be against fascism, just anti-Semitism. What kind of political sense does that make?" "I hear that the Board of Deputies of British Jews says the same as the Chronicle," Ethel persisted. "Apparently there was an announcement yesterday in all the synagogues." "Those so-called deputies are all rightnicks from Golders Green," Bernie said with contempt. "They've never been insulted on the streets by fascist hooligans." "You're in the Labour Party," Ethel said accusingly. "Our policy is not to confront the fascists on the streets. Where's your solidarity?" Bernie said, "What about solidarity with my fellow Jews?" "You're only Jewish when it suits you, and you've never been abused on the street. All the same, the Labour Party has made a political mistake. Just remember, if you allow the fascists to provoke violence, the press will blame the left for it, regardless of who really started it." Lenny said rashly, "If Mosley's boys start to fight, they'll get what's coming to them." Ethel sighed.
"Think about it, Lenny. In this country, who's got the most guns? You and Lloyd and the Labour Party, or the Conservatives with the army and the police on their side?"
"Oh," said Lenny. Clearly he had not considered that. Lloyd said angrily to his mother,
How can you talk like that? You were in Berlin 3 years ago. You saw how it was. The German left tried to oppose fascism peacefully, and look what happened to them.
Bernie put in, the German Social Democrats failed to form a popular front with the communists. That allowed them to be picked off separately. Together they might have won.
Bernie had been angry when the local Labour Party branch had refused an offer from the communists to form a coalition against the march. Ethel said, an alliance with communists is a dangerous thing. She and Bernie disagreed on this. In fact, it was an issue that split the Labour Party. Lloyd thought that Bernie was right and Ethel wrong.
We have to use every resource we've got to defeat fascism, he said. Then he added diplomatically, but Mam's right. It will be best for us if today goes off without violence.
It will be best if you all stay home and oppose the fascists through the normal channels of democratic politics, Ethel said.
You tried to get equal pay for women through the normal channels of democratic politics, Lloyd said. You failed.
Only last April, women Labour MPs had promoted a parliamentary bill to guarantee female government employees equal pay for equal work. It had been voted down by the male-dominated House of Commons.
You don't give up on democracy every time you lose a vote, Ethel said crisply.
The trouble was, Lloyd knew, that these divisions could fatally weaken the anti-fascist forces, as had happened in Germany. Today would be a harsh test. Political parties could try to lead, but the people would choose whom to follow. Would they stay at home, as urged by the timid Labour Party and the Jewish Chronicle? Or would they come out onto the streets in their thousands and say no to fascism? By the end of the day, he would know the answer. There was a knock at the back door, and their neighbor Sean Dolan came in dressed in his church-going suit.
I'll be joining you after Mass, he said to Bernie. Where should we meet up?
Gardner's Corner, not later than 2 o'clock, said Bernie. We're hoping to have enough people to stop the fascists there.
You'll have every dock worker in the East End with you, said Sean enthusiastically.
Millie asked, Why is that? The fascists don't hate you, do they?
You're too young to remember, you darling girl, but the Jews have always supported us, Sean explained. In the dock strike of 1912, when I was only 9 years old, my father couldn't feed us, and me and my brother were taken in by Mrs. Isaacs, the baker's wife in New Road. May God bless her great big heart. Hundreds of dockers' children were looked after by Jewish families then. It was the same in 1926. We're not going to let the bloody fascists come down our streets. Excuse my language, Mrs. Leckwith.
Lloyd was heartened. There were thousands of dockers in the East End. If they showed up en masse, it would hugely swell the ranks. From outside the house came the sound of a loudspeaker.
Keep Mosley out of Stepney, said a man's voice. Assemble at Gardner's Corner at 2 o'clock.
Lloyd drank his tea and stood up. His role today was to be a spy, checking the position of the fascists and calling in updates to Bernie's Jewish People's Council. His pockets were heavy with big brown pennies for public phones. I'd better get started, he said. The fascists are probably assembling already. His mother got up and followed him to the door.
Don't get into a fight, she said. Remember what happened in Berlin.
I'll be careful, Lloyd said.
She tried a light tone.
Your rich American girl won't like you with no teeth.
She doesn't like me anyway.
I don't believe it. What girl could resist you?
I'll be all right, ma'am, Lloyd said. Really, I will.
I suppose I should be glad you're not going to bloody Spain.
Not today, anyway.
Lloyd kissed his mother and went out. It was a bright autumn morning, the sun unseasonably warm. In the middle of Nutley Street, a temporary platform had been set up by a group of men, one of whom was speaking through a megaphone.
People of the East End, we do not have to stand quiet while a crowd of strutting anti-Semites insults us.
Lloyd recognized the speaker as a local official of the National Unemployed Workers Movement. Because of the Depression, there were thousands of unemployed Jewish tailors. They signed on every day at the Settle Street Labor Exchange. Before Lloyd had gone 10 yards, Bernie came after him and handed him a paper bag of the little glass balls that children called marbles.
I've been in a lot of demonstrations, he said. If the mounted police charge the crowd, throw these under the horse's hooves.
Lloyd smiled. His stepfather was a peacemaker almost all the time, but he was no softy. All the same, Lloyd was dubious about the marbles. He had never had much to do with horses, but they seemed to him to be patient, harmless beasts, and he did not like the idea of causing them to crash to the ground. Bernie read the look on his face and said, "Better a horse should fall than my boy should be trampled." Lloyd put the marbles in his pocket, thinking that it did not commit him to using them. He was pleased to see many people already on the streets. He noted other encouraging signs. The slogan, "They shall not pass," in English and Spanish, had been chalked on walls everywhere he looked. The communists were out in force, handing out leaflets. Red flags draped many windowsills. A group of men wearing medals from the Great War carried a banner that read, "Jewish Ex-Servicemen's Association." Fascists hated to be reminded how many Jews had fought for Britain. 5 Jewish soldiers had won the country's highest medal for bravery, the Victoria Cross. Lloyd began to think that perhaps there would be enough people to stop the march after all. Gardner's Corner was a broad 5-way junction, named for the Scottish clothing store, Gardner and Company, that occupied a corner building with a distinctive clock tower. Lloyd saw, when he got there, that trouble was expected. There were several first aid stations and hundreds of St. John ambulance volunteers in their uniforms. Ambulances were parked in every side street. Lloyd hoped there would be no fighting, but better to risk violence, he thought, than to let the fascists march unhindered. He took a roundabout route and came toward the Tower of London from the northwest, in order not to be identified as an East Ender. Some minutes before he got there, he could hear the brass bands. The tower was a riverside palace that had symbolized authority and repression for 800 years. It was surrounded by a long wall of pale old stone that looked as if the color had been washed out of it by centuries of London rain. Outside the walls, on the landward side, was a park called Tower Gardens, and here the fascists were assembling. He estimated there were already a couple of thousand of them, in a line that stretched back westward into the financial district. Every now and again they broke into a rhythmic chant.
1, 2, 3, 4, we're gonna get rid of the Yids, the Yids, the Yids, we're gonna get rid of the Yids.
They carried Union Jack flags. Why was it, Lloyd wondered, that the people who wanted to destroy everything good about their country were the quickest to wave the national flag? They looked impressively military, in their wide black leather belts and black shirts, as they formed neat columns across the grass. Their officers wore a smart uniform, a black military-cut jacket, grey riding breeches, jack boots, a black cap with a shiny peak, and a red and white armband. Several motorcyclists in uniform roared around ostentatiously, delivering messages with fascist salutes. More marchers were arriving, some of them in armored vans with wire mesh at the windows. This was not a political party. It was an army. The purpose of the display, Lloyd figured, was to give them false authority. They wanted to look as if they had the right to close meetings and empty buildings, to burst into homes and offices and arrest people, to drag them to jails and camps and beat them up, interrogate and torture them, as the brown shirts did in Germany under the Nazi regime, so admired by Mosley and the Daily Mail's proprietor, Lord Rothermere. They would terrify the people of the East End, people whose parents and grandparents had fled from repression and pogroms in Ireland and Poland and Russia. Would EastEnders come out on the streets and fight them? If not, if today's march went ahead as planned, what might the fascists dare tomorrow? He walked around the edge of the park, pretending to be one of the 100 or so casual onlookers. Side streets radiated from the hub like spokes. In one of them, he noticed a familiar-looking black-and-cream Rolls-Royce drawing up. The chauffeur opened the rear door, and, to Lloyd's shock and dismay, Daisy Peshkov got out. There was no doubt why she was here. She was wearing a beautifully tailored female version of the uniform, with a long grey skirt instead of the breeches, her fair curls escaping from under the black cap. Much as he hated the outfit, Lloyd could not help finding her irresistibly alluring. He stopped and stared. He should not have been surprised. Daisy had told him she liked Boy Fitzherbert, and Boy's politics clearly made no difference to that. But to see her obviously supporting the fascists in their attack on Jewish Londoners rammed home to him how utterly alien she was from everything that mattered in his life. He should simply have turned away. but he could not. As she hurried along the pavement, he blocked her way.
"What the devil are you doing here?"
he said brusquely. She was cool.
"I might ask you the same question, Mr. Williams," she said. "I don't suppose you're intending to march with us."
"Don't you understand what these people are like? They break up peaceful political meetings. They bully journalists. They imprison their political rivals. You're an American. How can you be against democracy?"
"Democracy is not necessarily the most appropriate political system for every country in all times."
She was quoting Mosley's propaganda, Lloyd guessed. He said, "But these people torture and kill everyone who disagrees with them." He thought of Jörg. "I've seen it for myself, in Berlin. I was in one of their camps, briefly. I was forced to watch while a naked man was savaged to death by starving dogs. That's the kind of thing your fascist friends do." She was unintimidated. "And who exactly has been killed by fascists here in England recently?"
"The British fascists haven't got the power yet, but your Mosley admires Hitler. If they ever get the chance, they'll do exactly the same as the Nazis."
"You mean they will eliminate unemployment and give the people pride and hope?" Lloyd was drawn to her so powerfully that it broke his heart to hear her spouting this rubbish.
"You know what the Nazis have done to the family of your friend Ava."
"Ava got married, did you know?" Daisy said, in the determinedly cheerful tone of one who tries to switch a dinner table conversation to a more agreeable topic.
"To nice Jimmy Murray. She's an English wife now."
"And her parents?"
Daisy looked away.
"I don't know them. But you know what the Nazis have done to them." Ava had told Lloyd all about it at the Trinity Ball. "Her father is no longer allowed to practice medicine. He's working as an assistant in a pharmacy. He can't enter a park or a public library. His father's name has been scraped off the war memorial in his home village." Lloyd realized he had raised his voice. More quietly, he said, "How can you possibly stand side by side with people who do such things?" She looked troubled, but she did not answer his question. Instead, she said, "I'm late already. Please excuse me."
"What you're doing can't be excused."
The chauffeur said, "All right, sonny, that's enough." He was a heavy middle-aged man who evidently took little exercise, and Lloyd was not in the least intimidated, but he did not want to start a fight.
"I'm leaving," he said in a mild tone, "but don't call me Sonny."
The chauffeur took his arm. Lloyd said, "You'd better take your hand off me, or I'll knock you down before I go." He looked into the chauffeur's face. The chauffeur hesitated. Lloyd tensed, preparing to react, watching for warning signs, as he would in the boxing ring. If the chauffeur tried to hit him, it would be a great swinging haymaker of a blow, easily dodged. But the man either sensed Lloyd's readiness or felt the well-developed muscle in the arm he was holding. For one reason or the other, he backed off and released his grip, saying, "No need for threats." Daisy walked away. Lloyd looked at her back in the perfectly fitting uniform as she hurried toward the ranks of the fascists. With a deep sigh of frustration, he turned and went in the other direction. He tried to concentrate on the job at hand. What a fool he had been to threaten the chauffeur. If he had got into a fight, he would probably have been arrested. Then he would have spent the day in a police cell. And how would that have helped defeat fascism? It was now 12:30. He left Tower Hill, found a telephone box, called the Jewish People's Council, and spoke to Bernie. After he reported what he had seen, Bernie told him to make an estimate of the number of policemen in the streets between the tower and Gardner's Corner. He crossed to the east side of the park and explored the radiating side streets. What he saw astonished him. He had expected 100 or so police. In fact, there were thousands. They stood lining the pavement, waited in dozens of parked buses, and sat astride huge horses in remarkably neat rows. Only a narrow gap was left for people who wanted to walk along the streets. There were more police than fascists. From inside one of the buses, a uniformed constable gave him the Hitler salute. Lloyd was dismayed. If all these policemen